I'd like to welcome you this afternoon to the Paul A. Olson Seminar. It's an honor to introduce our speaker this afternoon. Thomas Gannon grew up in western South Dakota and earned his BA and MA degrees from the University of South Dakota. He received his PhD in English from the University of Iowa, and he's an associate professor of English and Ethnic Studies here at the University of Nebraska. And it's important to note that he received the College of Arts and Sciences Distinguished Teaching Award a few years ago also. His interests include Native American literature, British Romantic literature, critical theory, avian and animal representation in literature. His book, Skylark Meets Meadowlark, Reimagining the Bird in British Romantic and Contemporary Native American Literature, was published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2009. The title of Tom's presentation is Avians and Indians, Feathered Folk on the Plains. Tom?
Thank you all for coming out. First of all, this is a photo I took a summer or two ago of the Little Bighorn battlefield for that Great Plains feel. I know we're into that. And that's, I think it's a mutant meadowlark. It's a little little bigger than usual. And that's a meadowlark. To wake you up, I know it's been a long day. They told me it wouldn't be a bad idea if I talked about my first book, which is still coming out, I think. It's called, again, Skylark Meets Meadowlark, but the original title was the title of this talk, Avians and Indians, and I still like that more. But they told me I had to remind the audience that it's a two-part book. The first half is largely about the British Romantic poets. The second half is about Native American literature. And so we have this rather lugubrious image of a skylark meeting a meadowlark. You know, hello, Mr. Meadowlark. Hey, I'm Skylark. And I still don't get it. But instead of reading passages from my book dryly from a piece of paper, I'm trying to give you a more graphical presentation of some of the main ideas of the book. I'm going to start with some of the main theses involved and then give you some what I call exhibits from both British Romanticism, and ultimately we get to Great Plains Native American poems about birds. Some themes then. British Romantic poetry represented a radically positive turn in Western literature in terms of eco-consciousness and animal rights. In fact, recent eco-critics like Jonathan Bate, James McCusick, Carl Kroeber, they love the Romantics. Oh man, environmentalism, animal rights, they were the first. You know, William Blake, a robin redbreast in a cage puts all heaven in a rage. And I claim this especially to be true for my favorite poet of all time, maybe William Wordsworth, and a recent discovery, John Clare. Well, the eco-critics just love him. In some of Clare's poems, it's as if the human ego just disappears completely, and we're left with this bird, you know, tending a nest. And it's a marvelous erasure of the human, I think. I also claim that this movement came the closest in mainstream Western canonical literature of feeling rather native in this regard. In fact, when I was first getting my degrees, they told me, you can't do Native American literature. There's no future in it. It's niche. You know, there's no status. And so I ran to the Romantics because to me they seemed to be the closest thing going. That reminded me of what goes on in Black Elk Speaks, for instance. However, lament the bad news. By the second generation of British Romanticism, Keats, Shelley, Byron especially, the bird, as central emblem of this nascent eco-consciousness, had retreated to its usual literary place as symbol of ethereality, poetic flight, fancy. You know, John Keats' fancy becomes a bird over and over. And the ubiquitous soul. The bird is so theologically loaded, invested in Western literature, that the real bird pretty much disappears. So my first exhibit, this is parts of the last two stanzas of Keats' Ode to a Nightingale. Maybe perhaps one of the most famous bird poems ever written, besides The Raven, maybe. But what he does, it should be called Ode to My Soul Self. It's not about a nightingale. Read that whole poem, you can't even imagine a nightingale, unless you're British. And the poem is about John Keats. It's about the romantic ego. And this is the theme of British Romanticism. It's all about me. Unfortunately, I don't like being me that much. So I'm always trying to erase it by identifying with other species, the natural landscape itself. And ultimately, I want to create some dissolution of ego consciousness by the end. So we get, thou wast not born for death, immortal bird. What? I'm pretty sure all nightingales have died or will die. So it's just total gibberish. No hungry generations tread thee down. And the final stanza, forlorn. Oh, those nightingales make me so sad. They must be sad singers. You listen to a nightingale song objectively, there's nothing sad about it. You know, Coleridge himself, a generation before, writes, in nature there's nothing melancholy. And so this whole forlornness and melancholia is projected from the poet's psyche upon this other species, thus erasing that other species. The very word is like a bell to toll me back from thee to my soul self. Adieu, the fancy, that key word. The whole poem is a fancy. Cannot cheat so well as she is famed to do, deceiving elf. Adieu, adieu, thy plaintive anthem fades. You're such a plaintive bird. You make me feel plaintive too. Passing your meadows, over the still stream, up the hillside, now 'tis buried deep in the next valley glades. Was it a vision or a waking dream? Well, whatever it wasn't a real bird. Fled is that music. Do I wake or sleep? And here's that characteristic romantic dissolution of ego consciousness, because it's so damn painful to be conscious of the fact that you're separated from the rest of the universe. Either that lone, romantic, capital E ego or I. Shelley, the other most famous poem in romantic, in British romanticism at least, To a Skylark, a couple passages. Hail to thee, real skylark. Oh no, it's blithe spirit. Bird thou never wert. And I have a great sentence in my book that says, well, that's for damn sure. That from heaven or near it. And here's the theological getting intermixed into the material reality of an actual other species. Pours thy full heart in profuse strains of unpremeditated art for the romantics overburdened by human consciousness. Now, where do they go for unconscious creative inspiration? It's the instinctual, the animal. And so birds serve as an emblem for this quite often. And of course, instead of the melancholy of the nightingale, the skylark is pure mania. And one of my sub-theses in the book is the romantics tended to oscillate between this melancholia and this mania. And they use these contrasting birds to represent that. So it was kind of a general bipolar disorder, I think. Teach me half the gladness that thy brain must know. Such harmonious madness from my lips would flow. The world should listen then as I am listening now. And the third famous bird from British romanticism, the albatross, of course. I got an albatross around my neck. It becomes proverbial. But of course, by the time it becomes the proverb, the trope, the metaphor, the original fact is in this poem, what's the main plot line? This bird gets murdered by this uncaring human who is detached from any love and connection with the rest of the biosphere. So it lengthened across an albatross, through the fog it came, as if it had been a Christian soul. We hailed it in God's name. And by the end of the poem, the Christian theology becomes so intertwined as a moral, as a lesson, that the original albatross, again, is where? God save the ancient mariner from the fiends that plague thee thus. Why looks that so? Well, with my crossbow, I shot the albatross. I killed another life form. Unfortunately, by the end of the poem, we get this homiliac. We'll see. Ah, well a day, what evil looks had I from old and young. Instead of the cross, the albatross about my neck was hung. And this is the proverbial use of the albatross that I spoke of. And we get people like ego critic James McCusick says, this poem is a wonderful example of an almost pure reconnection with other species, animal rights and all that, true ecology. And of course, the stanza that these critics point to is this one. This is after he's blessed those snakes, the water snakes, oh, those infernal beings. But no, they're also part of the ecosystem. I acknowledge you. I embrace you. And it's a wonderful moment. But again, I claim the Christian theology overrides any possibility of an authentic connection with other species. And he prayeth best, who loveth best, all things both great and small. That'd make a good book title. For the dear God who loveth us, he made and loveth all. But the impression I get from the rest of the poem, and intertextually with Genesis, it's hard for me to conceive a theology that claims that humankind is the center of the universe to actually mean this. And so I argue against McCusick's enthusiastic reading of this as this wonderful, you know, environmental embracement of the rest of the ecosystem. So to get back to my theses, the typical Western literary methodology thus has largely remained an ideological mechanism by which the human writer employs the animal other, I put animal in quotes, it's a bogus binary, to recuperate the human self, using the other species as mere trope, again, for the same old human, all too human Let's finally turn to Native American literature, from traditional texts issuing directly from the oral tradition to contemporary Native American poetry. I then identify a far contrasting view of other species in general and of birds in particular. Such an eco-attitude, I argue, arises by and large from a tribal indigenous attitude in which other species are not lower strata on some great chain of being or even on some Darwinian progressive evolutionary tree. I know that the various readings of Darwinism are controversial, but I think that's the main impression I get from 20th century meanings of what Darwin said. But rather a kith and kin in a non-hierarchical familial nest. I apologize. I'm anticipating a passage by Black Elk, of course. Getting tired of that metal arc yet? However, there's also, and this is the main problem here, I mean, I'm not trying to set up some binary between Western lit, Romantic lit, and, Native American lit, because there's so much, you know, cross-cultural, you know, hybridization, that to do so is incredibly problematic. However, there's also the not-so-small matter of genetic and cultural and literary hybridity. In many ways, contemporary Native lit can be seen as a neo-romanticism, very much so. A body of work very much influenced by the literary naturism of Wordsworth, Whitman, et al. In fact, it's clear to me now that after this book's publication, that distinguishing between the far-flung influences of indigenous traditionalism and Western romanticism is a problematic project indeed. The Mohawk poet Maurice Kenney said at one point, "I grew up just totally idolizing Wordsworth. I was in the throes of Wordsworth," he put it. And he said, "I wrote most of my worst poems under that influence," but I don't know what he meant by that. The Abenaki poet Joseph Bruschock idolizes Walt Whitman. You could write a whole essay, long essay, on Native American writers who just love Walt Whitman and his barbaric yap and all that. But I do assert by book's end that contemporary Native literature, in many ways a discursive dance of feathers, should be one of the central sets of voices leading to a new eco-vision in which other species are allowed veritable entrance into the current, still very limited sphere of all creatures, great and small. I see that happening in the zeitgeist, you know, Native American literature or not. I mean, the younger generation especially, and it's a wonderful thing. And an eagle feather. Do you see that image, and do you think Indian right away? Indians and eagles, eagle feathers. Of course, the birds and Indians connection already entails a good deal of cultural stereotyping and cliche. Like my audio there, that was a cut and paste of a synthesized drum and a synthesized rattle. This is authentic, isn't it? Specializing in authenticity. Tom Gannon's talk, thank you. And, as Deloria tells us, reminds us over and over again, New Age posering, if that's a word. The eagle and eagle feather specifically have long been in mainstream culture, the iconic signifiers of Native spirituality. You know, so I'm in danger here. I'm trying to make the point, you know, Indians and birds, you know, like this. But it's also the stereotype of mainstream culture about Indians. But the stereotype does have its origin in specific Native cultural verities, in tribal practices and beliefs that can't be denied. One of my mentors at Iowa, and he was German, and I can't do his German accent, but it even sounds better in German. Upon learning that my mixed-blood Irish-French Lakota persona still wanted to write at length about such an Anglo-canonical figure as Wordsworth, made the point that the sage of Grasmere could only write about eagles, but never conceive of being one. But he's setting up a binary here that I don't want to embrace, you know. I think cultural hybridity is the key. You know, to me, it's a continuum of distance from other species and othering thereof, and a veritable recognition and embracement of other species as veritable life forms. And I think Wordsworth does that sometimes. There's Native American poets that don't. They just capitalize the eagle, write a poem that sounds like Robert Bly, say, "I'm part Indian, it's an Indian poem, I'm doing some bird stuff." You know, Wordsworth does so much better than that. At points. In contrast, that mentor had witnessed Native American dances in which such a possibility seemed very much realized. That's a line from Paul Gunn Allen. Let's dance the dance of feathers, the dance of birds. This is a Saskatchewan tribe. I forget the name, maybe Fran knows. But they're doing a dance specifically called the Prairie Chicken Dance. And there's the same dance again. Up there is the Blackfoot Dance from Montana, doing another dance specifically called the Prairie Chicken Dance. And that's just a bad painting of a prairie chicken. And the point is, you know, I'm not an anthropologist, and I'm not going to say, "God, well, they're just doing this sympathetic magic thing, imitation." And it's much deeper than that, I think. But I still have this problem. I'm arguing that there is this deep connection between human indigenous Native Americans and aliens before contact. However, as soon as a white contact occurs, it gets doubled back and it becomes a stereotype projected upon Native Americans because, guess what? We're in the New World. This is a savage land. There are savage animals there, including the birds. Passenger pigeon, in French, pigeon sauvage, you know, the savage pigeon. I mean, we consider Indian history. Whites were advancing not only in the Indians, you know, fit for slaughter because they're savages, subhuman, non-Christian, but on the chickadees listening, the bird unconcerned, the deer scratching, the passenger pigeon doomed for extinction, like many Native American tribes, languages. The next passage is by somebody associated with AIM, so it's a little, it's a touch angry. Excuse me. And it's a reference to Martha again. Who is the last passenger pigeon? Died in the Cincinnati Zoo in 1914. Spent the last several years of her life alone. Her husband, George, had died. That's a sad deal in itself. Perhaps this is why the Smithsonian Institution keeps so many of our ancestors tucked away in boxes. There go the AGBRA Act, ultimately. Someday they hope to mount and display the last Indian and give him a cute name like they did Martha, the last passenger pigeon. And no doubt, they'll feel a certain pride in having the last one before we became extinct, just like they do with Martha. And so we have the original connection, we have the projected connection on the part of white colonizers, and then we have this fellow reinscribing back that original reinscription by white colonialism. To segue to the Lakota per se, then, via prairie chicken dancing, Standing Bear tells us that the Lakota dancer was such a close observer of animal life that his imitations of walk, manner, and behavior of animals were most artful. Again, it's just not imitation or some old theory about sympathetic magic. There's a quite non-hierarchical humility, and Vine Deloria says this over and over again, involved in the Lakota perception of other species as co-evolving equals, even elders that one can learn from. And one thing you see in so many different tribal literatures is this acknowledgement that, you know, we humans are a young species, so why can't we learn from the other species? The same species egalitarianism allows Standing Bear to lament, "I know of no species of plant, bird, or animal that was exterminated until the coming of the white man." Apologies to Mr. Cratch. The white man considered natural animal life just as he did the natural man life upon this continent. Again, avians equal Indians, in terms of being subhuman. As pests, plants which the Indian found beneficial were also pests. There is no word in the Lakota vocabulary with the English meaning of this word. And just to continue that theme with a contemporary author who's really angry about this, and I don't blame her, Leslie Silko, you know, she's often angry about a lot of things. This is actually originally one of the poetic interludes in Ceremony, I believe. "Then they, the colonizers, grow away from the earth. They write poems about nightingales in which the nightingale is never present." I think there's a truth to that analogy I just made. "Then they grow away from the plants and animals. They see no life. When they look, they see only objects. The world is a dead thing for them. They will kill the things they fear, all the animals, and Native Americans when you get around to it." That's a mental arc. So in Lakota, we have this phrase, Lakota Oyate, the Lakota people. Oyate people, often translated as nations, but I think that has too much of a, well, I'll explain in a minute. Lakota people. Shahila Oyate, the Cheyenne people. The Wambrio Oyate, the Eagle people. I mean, you see Eagle Nation too, but again, I think nation has human political connotations that don't work so well for me. I like people better. Tatanka Oyate, Buffalo people. Tashiagnumpa Oyate, mutant metal arc people. And Black Elk speaks. Black Elk is acutely aware of the Lakota people's long perceived close kinship with the avian. Birds make their nests in circles, for theirs is the same religion as ours. And so Lakota teepees were round like the nests of birds, and these were always set in a circle, a nation's hoop, a nest of many nests. And this is an interesting part of his biography, as told by John G. Neihardt. When his people were finally jammed into square boxes, you know, framed houses, Black Elk became a lost bird out of his native element. I mean, he lost his powers, his vision, because he was out of place and in a square, not a circle. Sitting Bull, too. And if you didn't know, Sitting Bull was actually more of a, you know, holy man, Wichashua Khan, than he was a warrior. I mean, he had his vision quest, his Umblechia. And as usual, his visions and dreams often involved birds. Sitting Bull was a lifelong interlocutor with Flicker and Meadowlark. And thus, to quote K. Kenneth Lincoln, an interspecies Wichashawa Khan. I like that. But again, if you examine the vision quest of most Wichashawa Khans, it's almost always interspecies. The young Sitting Bull became a friend of the birds because he owed the saving of his life to a dream in which an encounter with a grizzly bear was foretold by a bird, the flicker mentioned above. And so his song to that pretty avian savior above, a yellow hammer, and so his song to that pretty avian savior above. Indeed, Sitting Bull always spoke of birds and his final stories about the bird people. And fittingly, it was a meadowlark he told Sitting Bull of his approaching murder. Kenneth Lincoln also makes the argument that, well, of course, as with Joshua Khan, Sitting Bull also wrote songs for the people to sing during ceremonies. Lincoln says, this song actually sounds like a meadowlark. Notice the leaps of fourths and fifths in it. But so I played on my guitar, and I'm thinking, doesn't sound like a meadowlark to me. It sounds like a guitar. No, but examine most Lakota songs, and the leaps of fourths and fifths are very common. And so it's a rather ingenious argument on Kenneth Lincoln's part, but I don't believe it, I don't think. It would be nice to believe. Lame Deer, these are all Lakota, by the way. His humblechia, or vision quest, in which he was called to become a Wichashawa Khan, was a calling by birds, specifically, whom, as the vision developed, he could understand. You know, down there with me in that my cramped hole was a big bird whose feathers were touching my back and head. And I know after 4 days and nights of sensory deprivation, it's easy to give a physiological explanation for this. But then there came a voice trying to tell me something. It was a bird cry, but I tell you, I began to understand some of it. And all at once, I was way up there with the birds. At this point, the voice says to him, "We are the fowl people, the winged ones." The fowl people, not a great translation from the Lakota. "We are the fowl people, the winged ones, the eagles and the owls. We are a nation, Oyate. We are a people, and you shall be our brother. You will never kill or harm any one of us." I got students who say, well, 4 days of sensory deprivation. I could do acid and have this happen to me. And I'm saying, yeah, but they think you're an idiot. You come back and report that and say, yes, let's all follow the bird people. Our culture is not set up for that belief. Within the Lakota culture and the tradition of Wichashawa Khan, birds speaking, common thing. It was accepted within that cultural worldview. You'll call it a theology, if you will. So this climactic epiphany of Lame Deer's vision quest offers a Lakota worldview that today's ecologically minded might quote fondly and yet consider quaintly antiquated and downright superstitious. Yes, the contemporary animal rights advocate might easily embrace Lame Deer's vision as a metaphorical truth, but to imagine the avian-human relationship as a viable speaking kinship, to envision other species as oyate, as peoples, on a level equal to humankind, so far in Western ecological and eco-critical writing, this has been but a cognitive truth, not an intuitive one. Perhaps it's time for a new worldview, then, that synthesizes the theoretical utterances of deep ecology, which is known for its bio-egalitarianism, its equal rights for other species, although the term rights is not used by deep ecologists, with the practical and emotional attitude that might conceive of an eagle nation as a veritable race and people worthy of negotiation. Of course, I conflate several species of eagles there. My bad. I call this slide Having Fun with Photoshop. Some of the common birds of the Great Plains that the Lakota knew and named and had specific stories about each. Of course, turkey vulture, red-tailed hawk, American crow, barn swallow. Besides the meadowlark and eagles, Wombly, the other Lakota have had names for a great variety of species of Great Plains birds, as any perusal of the Lakota dictionary will demonstrate. The turkey vulture, Echa, in contrast to the Western view, as this death monger, it's a much more positive, in many native tribes, much more positive conceived as an eco-cleanser, kind of the garbage person of the universe. Red-tailed hawk, Chanshka, I just like the name, Chanshka, isn't that kind of cool? Or Upiki. American crow, Kangi. What's cool about the crow, like the turkey vulture, it is this positive, garbage person in the universe. Read Joy Harjo's poetry. She's always talking about the crow and the garbage, finding hidden treasures. But in contrast to the Western view, it's one of the birds with the eagle. When you read the old ghost dance songs of the Great Plains tribes, with the eagle is bringing the message to the people. The eagle is bringing the message to the people. But some of them end, the crow is bringing the message of the people. This wonderful, positive, well, not re-inscription, a positive privileging of a bird usually reviled in Western discourse. Swallow, Let me practice this. Ichapchinchinchila. Excuse me, I only had 4 semesters in Lakota, and that was 30 years ago. But say the name again. Repeat after me. Okay. It's obviously onomatopoeic. This is wonderful. If you hear a swallow, a barn swallow, a twitter, you know, Ichapchinchinchila. Sounds just like that, right? Or close? Okay. And if you add ikpisha at the end, it becomes a barn swallow. I think I forgot the tree swallow. What's cool about the barn swallow? And it's fascinating to me how different cultures, you know, view specific species or genres of birds in totally different ways. I mean, barn swallow, flies around, eats bugs, you know, cool, cute. But, you know, for the Lakota warrior, the horse warrior, the barn swallow has a certain magic to it. Why? We'll see, it's elusive fly, and we'll see in the next slide. And of course, we have the Western meadowlark, Tashiagnupa, and this is the bird who speaks Lakota. This is the familial bird, the favorite. Now, this is an old Lakota war song, and it's dangerous to use Densmore's translations, but I will anyway, from Teton Sioux Music and Culture. In darting flight, I have sent a swallow nation. This is a warrior song. You know, don't you imagine, yes, in mighty flight, I send the great eagle. Going to kick some. No, in darting flight, I have sent a swallow nation. And I'm like, oh. The erratic flight I caused. Ahead of the gathering clouds, the darting flight I caused. My horse, like a swallow, was flying, running. It's totally interesting. Also, in Black Elk Speaks, at least at one point, maybe I think it's twice at least, Black Elk describes going into battle and making the sound of a goose. We're thinking, what? You ever been chased by a giant, you know, Canadian honker? You know what I'm talking about. So how does all this yap relate to literature? I don't know, so this is the end of my talk. Or I'll just continue. There's this wonderful essay by Julian Rice I used in my book called How the Bird That Speaks Lakota, the meadowlark again, earned its name. And I'd almost finished the book and come up with the main ideas I talked about to you. And Julian Rice comes along and says almost the same thing, and perhaps more radically in terms of opposition. Wordsworth and Shelley's response to the skylark are radically different from the traditional Lakota perception of the meadowlark. While both the English skylark and the American Western meadowlark nest on the ground, and though both have notably clear and musical voices, Wordsworth and Shelley are moved to emphasize the skylark's soaring flight, inspiration, the wings of poesy. We know all that. While the Lakota meadowlark is often shown defending her nest or perched on a teepee pole, speaking humorously and helpfully to human beings. You know, just good folk. The two British poets, Rice continues, derive no such warmth from their ethereal bird, which serves only to remind them of the burden of their humanity. You know, the curse of ego consciousness, as I would put it. You know. Unlike the animals of romantic and much 20th century British and American poetry, the meadowlark is neither more or less blessed than man. Rather, he exists in Lakota consciousness as both model and messenger. I'd say two things here. Wordsworth has lots of poems, or several poems at least, in which a skylark does return to the ground, you know, of hearth and home. In fact, Wordsworth is much more homebound, groundbound, than Keats and Shelley in general. It's also maybe too coincidental to point out that if you go to the Lakota dictionaries, they'll have a whole list of the different things that the Western meadowlark says. You know, I've seen lists of 12 or 15 different phrases. But they're conveniently things that the parents would say to, you know, disobedient kids, like get your butt home, little boy. And so that, yes, model and messenger, scolder, surrogate parent, quite often. So it's kind of interesting. So the first of my Native American exhibits from contemporary literature then, and Abushak Abenaki, we're talking Northeast. I just love this poem because I had to steal the last line for the title of chapter 5 of my book, A Beatitude of Birds. Let my words be bright with animals, images the flash of a gull's wing. If we pretend that we are at the center, that moles and kingfishers, eels and coyotes are at the edge of grace, then we circle dead moons about a cold sun. This morning I ask only the blessing of the crayfish, the beatitude of birds. This reinforces my main point that what I love about Native American literature is it's anti-homocentrism. It's anti-anthropocentrism. Humankind is not the center of the universe. We just pretend we are. And that's my main complaint about British Romantic poetry. I just love the imagism of this poem. And there's a great history between early imagism and its relationship with Native American quote-unquote poetry from Dinmore's translations and all, to this circling back in which contemporary Native poets have kind of adopted an imagistic style, you know, from American mainstream poetry. I am making the sound upon the earth. The curled leaf filled with water holds a looking glass of sky. Imagism, right? In a quiet place, I make this small sound. That's a downy woodpecker. I talked to Lance, and he said, it was a pretty big woodpecker. I said, no, it couldn't be, Lance. It's a downy woodpecker. As I rewrote his poem in criticism, you know, yeah, he was talking about like a flicker. I said, God, those are loud things. But, well, this is small talk now. I'm sorry. Let's move on. I had to have at least one meadowlark poem, or else all those meadowlarks would have been kind of useless. A meadowlark comes sailing across my windshield. This is Carter Rivard, Osage. With breast shining yellow, and five notes pierce the windshield like a flash. The five notes is kind of a simplification, I'd argue. If there are five notes, you know, some of those notes are pretty slurred and lots of subnotes. But I'm such a literalist sometimes. And I'm wanting to move again. I'm coming back to Oklahoma, you know, where my tribe originated. I'm driving back. You know how I know I'm home? Meadowlark with those five notes. To move again through country that a bird has defined holy with song. And maybe next time see how he flies so easy when he sings. You know, because he is completely at home. Several crow poems now, which kind of take the place of that vulture talk I was giving you about being the eco-cleansers of the universe. We can see the positive privilege of the crow's eco-duty of recycling, if you will, in this Silco poem, Preparations, in which a dead sheep on the roadside is carefully attended to by these avian agents of cleansing and completion. And I love the re-inscription of Christian imagery that runs through this. It's a ceremony of, you get the impression, wow, these are Jesuit priests or something. This last rites. They're crows. Look at the long black wings, the shining eyes, solemn and fat. The crows, the priests gather. Okay. The crows gather to make preparations. Your time is up, sheep. I've come to give you last rites. It'll be marvelous. Well, that's my mommative interpretation, I'm sorry. Only a few more days, they say to each other. A few more days, and this will be finished. It's apparently a big sheep. But my favorite crow poem is Linda Hogan's Crow Law. She's one of my favorite poets. And again, this religious imagery, you know, taken from Christian ceremonialism, gets reinscribed into something very material. This religion is a very strange ceremony, this poem, but it's the ceremony of real life. You know, I hate the fact my students say every time I teach this poem, not every time, but some, oh, that reminds me of the Lion King, Circle of Life. Oh, it's so deep, but I think, oh God, it's so much better than that. But the temple where crow worships walks forward in tall black grass. Betrayal is crow's way of saying grace to the wolf so it can eat what is left when blood is on the ground. So there's kind of a trickster thing going on here, but not necessarily. Until what remains of moose is crow walking out the sacred temple of ribs. We have this kind of upside down ribs of a moose stripped by the wolf. Then the raven, who's led the wolf to the moose so it too could eat. In a dance of leaving, the red tracks of scarce and private gods. It is the oldest war, because indeed, it is the circle of life. And I hate it when I mock my own seriousness. Where moose becomes wolf and crow, literally, materially. Where the road ceases to become the old forest. Where crow is calling, where we are still afraid. What are we afraid of? I love asking my students that, because then I can sit there for 5 minutes of silence. Of course, I can't omit at least one poem about the role of the corvid trickster. This isn't found much in Lakota literature, because, of course, in the trickster in Lakota, we got Iktomi the spider, got coyote in the creation myths. But noteworthy in this regard is Tlingit poet Robert H. Davis's Raven is Two-Faced, a playful postmodern treatment in which, although not speaking in the first person, like the woodpecker poem, and later on we'll see the hawk and the snake. This two-faced bird seems to be actually writing the poem as in some of Ortiz's efforts. Simon Ortiz is good at this. For starters, the bird's very eyes are visual on-off binaries. Raven eyes blink day, night, day, night. It'd make a good YouTube video. The second half of the poem is itself a two-way blinking. That is, the trickster still at work, although to clarify my reference to its postmodern nature, the following also seems an apt description of Derridean deconstruction. You didn't know Indians could do that, did you? Definitely everything he's made certain is the opposite of something else. I mean, to me, the basic characteristic of the trickster is to turn things on their heads, to upset the status quo. You say you want a revolution. There's no way out of his two-sided setup. You can turn this poem inside out, trying to interpret its other meaning. And I've tried. One of my favorite native poets is Simon Ortiz, Acoma Pueblo. One of his earlier poems, Four Poems for a Child's Son, the eagle shows up over and over in Ortiz. We're going to have a few eagle poems now. But for Ortiz, the eagle is no Byronic ego uberales. I was proud of that when I came up with it. Now I can't even say it. Ego overall. If you read Lord Byron, Childe Harold, several of his other poems, he is, what kind of bird is Byron? He's the eagle. He's always talking about these lone eagles soaring above the Alps, etc. He identifies with the eagle. But it's a lone eagle. It's like a lone wolf away from the pack. It's not part of the rest of the biosphere. It is, again, it's an emblem of the romantic ego detached from everything else. Ego uberales. What did Hazlitt say about Byron? He said, Byron doesn't go to nature to paint her picture. Nature must come to him. Which basically says, as a romantic naturist, Byron really didn't give much. I think he was better as a neoclassical wit myself. Well, never mind that Byronic footnote. The eagle is no Byronic ego, romantic ego with a capital R and a capital E. No, a being who knows its place in the ecosystem. Everything that is around you is part of you, this poem asserts. And it is an ethic derived from the eagle. Ortiz will later claim in one interview, I write my poems by watching animals. You see, son, the eagle is a whole person. The way it lives, it means it has to do with paying attention to where it is. Sense of place. Sense of belongingness to the rest of the parts. Not the center of the earth. Not homocentrism. Not egocentrism. But eco-discentrism. I'm making things up now. Not the center of the earth especially, but part of it. One part among all parts. And then you can ask yourself, and I go back to my cultural hybridity thing, how much of this is Ortiz's Pueblo tradition? How much of this is verbiage from mainstream ecology, environmentalism? One part of many parts. I mean, isn't that the first thing we learned when we learned about ecology in eighth grade or so? I don't think that makes it a less effective poem. Linda Hogan does this the best. I mean, you can't tell where her deep knowledge of Western ecology ends and where her great respect for her Chickasaw, Oklahoma heritage ends or begins. I forgot what I said. This used to be one of my all-time favorite poems. I'm not so sure anymore. I've written on this poem several times in the book, several different essays. I think I use the phrase ecotherapeutic in my praise of the poem. Now lately, when I'm teaching the poem, I'm thinking, is she trying too hard to play upon this Western connection of eagle and Indian? And I'm still up in the air on it. So you think, to pray, and Joyce says that all of her poems can be called prayers in some sense. You open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon, to one whole voice that is you. And know there is more that you can't see, can't hear, can't know in languages that aren't always sound, but other circles of motion. And I love this idea in Hogan and Harjo that discourse, human language is not the only discourse. It's not the only semiotic. It's other species in motion. It's music. It's a metal arc song. Like Eagle that Sunday morning over Salt River, circled in blue sky and wind, swept our hearts clean with sacred wings. We see you, the eagle. You see ourselves and know that we must take the utmost care and kindness in all things. Breathe in, knowing we are made of all this, and breathe, knowing we are truly blessed because we were born and die soon within a true circle of motion. Like who? Like Eagle, rounding out the morning inside us. And we get that circle again, Black Elk speaks, and the teepees in a circle, and the bird's nest. We pray that it will be done in beauty, in beauty. Of course, I mean, you need a background in Native American cultures and literature to realize that that in beauty thing is, this is the Navajo night chant invoked. It's not an aesthetic beauty in the main sense. It's hojo, Navajo dine hojo, balance, you know, being a beautiful part of the whole, balance. Good definition, Tom. Linda Hogan again. What I like about her is she doesn't put much hui in this, you know, this quote-unquote native spiritualism stuff. You know, she says, what's really magical, what's really miraculous is the mundane, is the material. Right here is where the true magic of the universe lies, the true theology, if you will, to speak metaphorically. They, mainstream consciousness, think heaven is so far away, beyond the farthest downs, not beneath the mortal sky, not the radiant fields of potatoes brown with dust. You know, a simple, plain image, but so marvelous to express. Not the gold-eyed eagle perched in a tree with perfect feathers and bones of air. I see I'm running out of time. Let me skip ahead to a few more favorites, and then I'll sum up. Simon Ortiz from Hearts and Hearts. What's cool about this, it's this 1994 collection. Was it Before and After the Lightning? Most of the poems are set in southwestern South Dakota, you know, Pine Ridge Rez, often in the winter. This is the cold Great Plains. We just experienced this 2 weeks ago. And so in the human interaction, avian interaction of this poem, there are blue jays and pheasants, kind of an odd pairing, but it's reality, right? Outdoors, and we are indoors. We are human. They are animal. You know, that awful binary. We're animals too. But all partake in the knowledge of a bond of place, co-suffering plaintiffs in the harsh South Dakota winter. I like that sentence. I wrote it myself. Okay. They see us peering out of the window. You know, what's the first thing seeing here? The first subject? It's them. They're seeing us. And I find that to be a wonderful inversion. We see them in the yard. There's this reciprocity of vision. Eyes meeting eyes, hearts meeting hearts. Each of our lives a distance, yet together in this season. Feathers, skins, hearts and hearts, eyes, all the eyes, you know, all the oyate, that meet for seconds, instances holding to the fragile margin, that awful South Dakota winter, the season we come to know as our bond. I mean, this is, you know, Linda Hogan calls it, you know, there's some marvelous poems like this that do this, what Linda Hogan calls, you know, crossing the border of species. And it happens every now and then in the poems of contemporary Native American literature. And sometimes in Wordsworth. Geez, all those sparrows look alike. I'll conclude then. This is from Linda Hogan's prose text, a collection of essays. But I think it's some of her best poetry is in her prose. And some of her poetry is pretty prosaic, so it's kind of... Ours is a language of commerce and trade, of rationalism, of linearity, of laws that can be bent in order that treaties might be broken. Ooh. Land wounded beyond healing. It is a language that is limited emotionally and spiritually. You know, that has a word called pest in it. The ears of this language do not often hear the songs of the white egrets, so we make our own songs. And Harjo says in some of her poems, and other species make songs too. You know, they sing, dance, they have their own discourse. Because these are people too, or other parts of the family. To say that wilderness and water, blue herons and orange newts are invaluable, not just to us, but in themselves, that's what she wants to do. And I love her final line here. And of course, this is the quotation I used to introduce her section of chapter 5. Now I am a disciple of birds. I was talking about there's deep ecology. You know, my favorite, I guess, Western ecological movement. It's the most radical. It says all life forms should have are inherently valuable unto themselves. And that she's quoting deep ecology, basically, when she says, invaluable not just to us, for our own human interests. And why should we save the sandhill cranes? Well, so we can have tourism. No, aren't they wonderful unto themselves? But in themselves, intrinsic value, intrinsic worth in other life forms. Not because if that species goes extinct, we'll be in big trouble too. I mean, that's still homocentrism. Lame deer again, and finally, I think we're moving in a circle. And I talked about this zeitgeist that I see changing in the new recent generation of students, etc., even in the media, or maybe a spiral, going a little higher every time, but still returning to the same point. We're moving closer to nature again. I'm trying to bring the ghost dance back, but interpret it in a new way. You know, use it as a strong controlling trope, perhaps, for a change in consciousness. I believe that more and more people are sensing what we meant when we prayed for a new earth, the ghost dance, and that now not only the Indians, but everybody has become an endangered species, unless you watch Fox News, in which case, this is all lies. And so that's the last slide. What about my sound here? Oh, there it is. Oh, my book is on sale in the lobby. I just showed up to do that. Any questions now?